Hey, girl. Yes, you. You are seen. You are loved. And you were made for more. Hey, created especially for teen girls, chart-topping Christian artist Ann Wilson invites you to her 40-day devotional, Hey Girl. Through honest stories, scripture, and journal prompts, Ann talks about real struggles, comparison, insecurity, doubt, and faith, reminding you that God is always near and fighting for you. Hey Girl, from K-Love Books. Get your copy today at klove.com/books.
Donate and listen to the podcast at wrwl.org.
All righty, we're back as we continue with our Christmas story. And now Lisa Hickman will read a story about the gold wrapping paper.
Once upon a time, there was a man who worked very hard just to keep food on the table for his family. This particular year, a few days before Christmas, he punished his little 5-year-old daughter after learning that she had used up the family's only roll of expensive gold wrapping paper. As money was tight, he became even more upset when on Christmas Eve he saw that the child had used all of the expensive gold wrapping paper to decorate one shoebox she had put under the Christmas tree. He also was concerned about where she had gotten money to buy what was in the shoebox. Nevertheless, the next morning, the little girl, filled with excitement, brought the gift box to her father and said, "This is for you, Daddy." As he opened the box, the father was embarrassed by his earlier overreaction, now regretting how he had punished her. But when he opened the shoebox, he found it was empty, and again his anger flared. "Don't you know, young lady," he said harshly, "when you give someone a present, there's supposed to be something inside the package." The little girl looked up at him with sad tears rolling from her eyes and whispered, "Daddy, it's not empty. I blew kisses into it until it was all full." The father was crushed. He fell on his knees and put his arms around his precious little girl. He begged her to forgive him for his unnecessary anger. An accident took the life of the child only a short time later. It is told that the father kept this little gold box by his bed for all the years of his life. Whenever he was discouraged or faced difficult problems, he would open the box, take out an imaginary kiss, and remember the love of this beautiful child who had put it there.
Very good. Yeah. And now, Elder Barkley is going to read us the anonymous benefactor.
Amen. In summary, in The Anonymous Benefactor by Susan Easton Black, the narrator recalls a challenging Christmas season in 1977 as a graduate student raising 3 sons alone. Facing financial struggles and unable to afford gifts, the narrator receives an anonymous envelope containing money addressed to a very, 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 very special lady. After searching for the donor, the narrator realizes that the generous gift came from their own children who had emptied their cherished savings to bring joy to their mother. This heartwarming story highlights the selfless love of children and the true spirit of Christmas. It reads, "With a Cadillac, a maid, and a gardener, my family always had a Christmas with the best gifts from Santa's sleigh. My anticipation of opening gifts on Christmas Day was boundless, for I knew my mother was an uncontrolled shopper when it came to my whims. After opening one gift after another, I toted my new acquisitions up and down the street so all the neighbors would know that Santa loved me best and that my parents were spoiling me to my complete satisfaction. From such a worldly background of material prosperity, it seemed only natural for me to fantasize that when I had children of my own, the established tradition of wealth and abundant giving at Christmas would continue. If that had been the case, I would not have had one memorable Christmas, just more of the same. It was in 1977, almost 20 years ago, that my Christmas took a strange twist. circumstances had changed. I was no longer the little girl awaiting the parental handout, but was an adult attempting to make my own way in life. I was a graduate student in 1977, completing a doctoral degree and raising three small sons alone. Like several other graduate students, I had obtained university employment as a research writer for a professor. And like most of the students, I was struggling to meet my financial obligations. 5 days before Christmas, I realized that my mismanagement of funds would prevent much gift buying of any kind. It seemed unbearable to me. Cuddling my sons, I reluctantly explained my abhorrence of debt and the specter of our economic plight. My emotions surfaced as the children attempted to comfort me by nodding assuredly, "Don't worry, Santa Claus will give us gifts." Cautiously, I explained, "I think Santa Claus is also having a bad year." With certainty, my firstborn son, Brian, announced, "But on television, his sleigh is still filled with toys. With 5 days left till Christmas, he'll have plenty for us." His younger brother, Todd, interjected, "Besides, Santa won't forget us. We've been good this year." As all three nodded in agreement, I did too. My sons had been good. They had found happiness and friendship in our family. We all were unusually close. Perhaps it was our circumstance. Yet, despite their goodness, they would soon be disappointed because neither Santa nor Mother would bring the desired presents on Christmas Day. That night, I cried and pled with the Lord for relief, for a glimmer of hope that Christmas in our home would be better than I anticipated. My verbal prayers awakened the children. They seemed to intuitively know what was causing my unhappiness. "Don't worry about presents. It doesn't matter," said Brian. I knew it didn't matter on December 20th, but I knew it would be all important on December 25th. The next morning, I could not hide the despair and self-pity that had marred my face through the night. "What is wrong?" I was asked again and again at the university. My trite reply was, "Nothing." Arriving home, I methodically pulled the mail from the mailbox as I entered the house. A curious, unstamped envelope caught my attention. To a very, 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 very special lady was typewritten on the envelope. I gazed at the envelope and wondered if it were meant for me. Hoping it was, I tore it open. To my surprise, I found several dollars inside, but not a note of explanation. "Come quickly," I beckoned the children. Together, we counted the money, examined the envelope, and expressed wonder at the anonymous gift. This was a direct answer to my prayer. There was enough money in the envelope to buy an extra gift for each child. I was stunned and amazed, and my joy and excitement of Christmas had returned. It was going to be a great Christmas day after all. It wouldn't be as lavish as those of my childhood, but it would be good enough. I was curious. Where had the money come from? Could it be from a neighbor, a friend, a classmate, or the bishop? Logical deduction led me first to our near neighbors. As I attempted to thank them, each stammered and then confessed it wasn't me. Asking friends and classmates rendered similar comments. It must be the bishop, I decided. He denied being our benefactor, however, and assured us that he did not know who had been so kind. Curiosity mounted as nightfall approached. I read the envelope again to a very, 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 very special lady. This time I noticed that the E and the L were misshapen letters produced by an old typewriter ribbon. I also observed that each dollar bill had been folded and unfolded many times as if each one had been of infinite worth. My desire to uncover the identity of the anonymous donor grew. Soon, that desire was coupled with the gnawing resolve to return the money. The mishapen letters and folded bills evidenced that the generous donor also had financial difficulties. I couldn't sleep that night. Again and again, I asked myself, who was it? I had the clues of the old typewriter ribbon and the folded money, but not the answer. I can't really describe how I finally knew who the benefactor was, but about 2 o'clock in the morning, I knew. I knew who had a broken typewriter and who needed to replace the ribbon, and who carefully folded and unfolded money, checking each dollar bill. It was my three sons. With tears of love, I awoke the donors. Blurry-eyed, they asked, "What's wrong?" I replied, "Nothing's wrong. Everything is right. You gave me the money. You gave me all the money you possess." Opening the bedroom closet door, I pulled out three empty jars that once had contained their treasured fortune. They sat silent for several moments until my 9-year-old Brian turned to his young brother Todd and punched him. "You told," he exclaimed. Attempting to fend off further blows, Todd yelled, "It wasn't me. It must have been John." Their 5-year-old brother immediately said, "It wasn't me," as both boys landed on him. In unison, they asked, "How did you know?" I had searched outside my home for the answer, but the answer was within. I had seen generosity in all those around me, but had failed to recognize the generous hearts of my children. And now I more clearly knew why the Savior had said, "Suffer the little children to come unto me and forbid them not, for of such is the kingdom of heaven." My house, with all of its material flaws, was my heaven on earth, and my sons were the greatest treasure. Christmas 1977 was indeed a Merry Christmas worth remembering.
Very, very good. You know, it's sometimes just these little acts of kindness, if we remember, some people are just, you know, overwhelmed by little acts of kindness. I had went to the car wash, took my car through the car wash. I've got one of those things where they just read my plates and I get so many, as many car washes as I want. And anyhow, as I went through and it was cold, and the fellow that was washing the cars, he's out there. I had just prayed a couple of weeks prior with him. And that's not, you know, you don't make a lot of money running a car wash. And anyhow, so I handed him a $20 bill. He said, "What's this for?" I said, "It's for Christmas," you know. And it was like, he was amazed. Now, I would always give him a $5 tip when I went through there, but this time it was like, you know, $20 today is not much, okay?
Right.
But to him, it really meant a lot, you know. And same thing. I did the same thing. I went to the store where I would get a lot of, you know, animal feed and that, and there was a certain young lady that's always so nice. There's two of them working there, and they're so nice to me, so polite. Every time I come in there, they always, so the very same thing I did when I gave her, I said, "Here," and I handed her just a $20 bill, and it was like she was so taken back just a little bit. So just small acts of kindness like that today. And that's what Christmas is really all about. It's about, you know, that's what Christ is, just like we read with Papa Panhoff.
And mm-hmm.
like Joe said, when you've got him, you've got everything.
Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah, Pastor, I could really empathize yes. with this story here. It, born in the 70s, it took me back to, you know, the situation with my parents. And for many Christmases, my parents, they would go all out, and I would look under the Christmas tree and have many gifts. But there was one year that times it fell really hard, and it looked like I wasn't going to get anything. And in fact, that morning, I waking up and looking under the tree, there wasn't anything. But my mother, somehow she found this little teddy bear. It was new, but she gave that to me, and I felt so much love and so much warmth. And then, as of course I got older, my mom has passed on now, but the greatest thing that I appreciated from my mother and my dad was that they sold into me Christ. They taught me how we would have devotionals. And as I got older, I realized that on Christmas Day, there could be so many things that could be going wrong. But the fact that Jesus Christ was born, the fact that there's no greater gift than the gift of salvation, and no greater gift than a parent handing down the blueprint on how to follow Christ, I really cherish what she gave me, and that's the greatest gift. And so, again, this story, it really just, I could relate to it. There's so much warmth in this.
Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Oh, I was just relating to that, thinking back some of the most special times in life were times when there wasn't money around. Remember one year going up, we were in Oregon, drove way up and got a big noble fir for Christmas, brought it back. All the decorations on the tree were handmade. We didn't have any money. My son and I had gone out and we caught a bunch of fool hens in the trees. And for Christmas dinner, we had roast grouse. The Lord provided the food. And remember Christmas morning when we got up, there was a small herd of elk came down almost in the front yard and were drinking out of the little stream that ran by the cabin where we were living. And it was like one of the most beautiful Christmases ever. And I don't think it cost a dime, but it couldn't be replaced with all the money in the world.
Absolutely, and that's what Christmas is all about. Again, like you were saying, Jesus is the reason for the season, and it's the love of God mm-hmm. that makes Christmas Christmas, huh?
Yes. Yeah.
It's all about love.
That's it.
And I remember the tree, which reminds me, I've got some little bit of history from our good friend Bill Fetter. We used to travel around, go speaking with him when we were on that Shake the Nation tour. And anyway, he had some notes on where a lot of people will go, where did we get the Christmas tree from? Hmm. Well, the lights probably came first. I know it sounds like it's odd, but back at the Jewish had the Festival of Lights back in 165 B.C. before Christ. They talk about the, and then the first reference in the Catholic Church writings were the historian Tertullian back in 200 AD was talking about Christ, you are the light of the world, the tree evergreen, if you have renounced the heathen temple. Back about 400 years after Christ, a Catholic pastor, we don't call him priest, but his name was Winfried Boniface, was sent by Pope Gregory II as a missionary to the heathen Germans at a place called Gessmar, where he confronted this chieftain Gundahar, and they were getting ready to offer a little prince, Azel, as a bloody sacrifice to Thor, their pagan god. And they believed that on Earth, he lived in this huge blood oak tree. Well, when making a long story short, when Pastor Boniface arrived, he interrupted this sacrifice, and he took up an axe, and he swung a few blows at this mighty oak, and all of a sudden, this huge wind came out of nowhere and blew this giant oak completely over, and the tree fell with a tremendous noise. The heathens, the pagans there, were just in awe. So he spoke to them, pointing to an evergreen tree. This is what he said. This is the word. Not a drop of blood shall fall tonight, for this is the birth night of St. Christ, Son of the All-Father and Savior of the world. This little tree, a young child of the forest, shall be a home tree tonight. It is the wood of peace, for your houses are built of fir. It is the sign of endless life, for its branches are evergreen. See how it points to heaven? Let this be called the tree of the Christ child. Gather about it, not in the wild woods, but in your homes. There will shelter no deeds of blood, but loving gifts and lights of kindness. So, somebody had read this story, and his name was Martin Luther. Excuse me. Back in 1520, and this is a true story, Martin Luther was walking home on Christmas Eve under a very cold sky, December sky, and he was remarking about the countless stars that lit up the night. Well, when he returned home, to the delight of his children, he set up a small evergreen tree, placing a number of small candles on the branches. And he told his children of the Christ child, the light of the world, whose birth had so gloriously brightened the sky on that first Christmas Eve. Then he set up a manger scene under the tree so that the lights would appear as the stars above Bethlehem. And that is really how the story kind of evolved of the Christmas tree, and it was meant to celebrate Christ. It wasn't supposed to have, you know, paisley ornaments and chipmunks and moose and Mickey Mouse and all the things we see today. The lights, the tree evergreen pointing toward Christ, and it all over the manger scene depicting his birth on earth. And I wish we could have kept some of that real meaning of Christmas. And I know you and I try and put that out every year, but if you go to a big mall or a shopping center, you see the trees with all these balls of ornaments and color, but not a thing on the tree really would remind you of Christ, would it?
It will when you...
A tree like that, at a shopping mall, did you ever walk by and said, that reminds me of Christ and Christmas?
No. Not really, not today. But there are some.
That's why on our trees out here in Missouri, we decorate with Chrismon symbols. Symbols of everything on the tree represents Christ. And one of our favorite decorations is the candy cane. And if I have a minute, I'd like to say a couple of things about the candy cane.
Yep, go right ahead.
It's white. It's white for purity, because Jesus was what?
Pure.
Pure. He had this, when he... remember, the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and rolled back the stone from the door of the tomb. And what did Matthew say? His countenance was like lightning, his raiment white as snow. We see this white as purity, the angels wearing white. Revelation, his head and his hairs were white like wool, white as snow. So we know that white, so many different Bible verses. And when you decorate the tree with candy canes, you can look for all those. Talk about the armies in heaven clothed in white linen, you know, white and clean. Then the candy cane itself looks like two things. It looks like the staff. And we know, remember, in Judges, the angel of the Lord put forth the staff that was in his hand, and he touched the cakes that were on the unleavened bread on the fire of a rock. And this was in Judges. It talks about the angel with the staff. Jesus had, he said, what I took my staff, God, the, prophet, Zechariah, took my staff, even beauty, cut it asunder, that I may break my covenant, which I had made with the people. He had the staff. So the shepherd's staff, the cane, representing the shepherd's staff that he would haul in his sheep. There's a lot of references. Then, candy canes are usually have a spice. They're usually peppermint. Well, I remember the spices, the women came when Christ was in the tomb. They had spices to place in the body. We know the wise men came with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Those were two of the most expensive spices in the world. So the candy cane represents some of those. And then the candy canes have stripes. Jesus was scourged, right? On his back, he had the stripes. By those stripes, we were all healed. And there's probably about 8 or 10 Bible verses about stripes. Then, candy cane, those stripes are colored red, the red for blood. Like in Matthew, this is my blood of the New Testament, Jesus said, shed for many for the remission of sins. And you can go through, there's so many references to the blood, especially Revelation 19:13. And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood. And his name is called the Word of God. And last, candy cane is hard candy. And there are many verses. He is the rock. There is none holy as the Lord Christ. For there is none beside thee, neither is there any rock like our God. And we see all through Samuel, through Psalms, through Matthew, 1 Corinthians 10:4, and all that drink the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So you can do an entire Bible study just putting candy cane on a Christmas tree. And there are so many different verses for all of those things, the rock, the hardness, the cane, the color. Every year you can make it a little bit different as you decorate the tree, and then you can put on angels and shepherd and sheep and all these different symbols that represent Christ, the fish. We're made fishers of men. So it's something that started a new tradition for you and your family. Make an entire Bible study out of decorating your Christmas tree. And it doesn't have to be expensive. And like our little tree at our country church, almost everything on it's handmade by different members during the year. And we have an entire celebration. It takes about an hour and a half to decorate the tree and read all the different Bible verses. And it's one of the most beautiful worship services that I can remember. And I thought, what a year to maybe start a new tradition at your house. Right, Pastor?
I hear you. Well, I, you know, we often hear, Joe, about the that cold, cold, cold winter of December of 1776, how the soldiers, those in the Revolutionary Army, the War for Independence, how they did so much with so little that, you know, that's a saying we had in our ministry for years when I was in the Army. We've done so much with so little for so long, we can do almost anything with nothing. And here, that's about what they did. And so let's hear about the battles of Trenton and Princeton. In December of 1776, George Washington and his army were in retreat. The British had surrounded them on Long Island and New York, but under cover of darkness and by the providence of God, the American army outsmarted the British and reached safety in the state of New Jersey. Washington, with fewer men than the British, a lot fewer, began a fast-paced retreat across the state of New Jersey. With the retreat from Long Island, the entire country seemed discouraged. The Continental Congress was discouraged. The army was discouraged. The British wrote home that Washington did not dare to fight, and the war would be over in a few weeks. Little did they know that Washington's hope did not despair. But he kept faith in God. He told his men that if he had to, he would take his army to the backwoods of Virginia, which he knew so well, and make a last stand against the British. On December 11th, 1776, the Continental Congress called for a day of fasting and prayer throughout all the colonies. Samuel Adams said, "Let America exert her own strength, and God, who cannot be indifferent to our righteous cause, will even work miracles, if necessary, to establish her feet upon a rock." Meanwhile, Washington's troops had reached safety in Pennsylvania. The British ordered that all extra food and supplies were to be taken from all the families, even if the families were on the British side. Anyone who fired upon the British was to be hanged. During this period of the war, a new type of British soldier appeared. The king of the area in Europe, we now call Germany, had loaned some soldiers to the King of England. These Hessians, as they were called, were promised that they could take anything in plunder they found from the Americans and become rich. Thus they did with zeal. The Hessian troops were known throughout America for their cruelty. 1,000 of these troops had been placed in Trenton, New Jersey, by the British General Howe. About the 25th of December, Washington told his officers about a daring plan. All the boats on either side of the Delaware River for over 70 miles surrounding Trenton had been either obtained for use by the army or burned. Washington planned to march his men to Trenton, take the supplies, then march to Princeton and capture the supplies there. All day, on the 25th, Christmas Day, the Hessians had been celebrating. By nightfall, they were tired and ready for a good night's sleep. Little did they know the plans which were being played out just across the river. Washington began his march at 3 p.m. with about 2,400 men. Each man had only 40 rounds of ammunition with him and only 3 days of ration of food. 18 cannons were pulled by the teams of horses. It was very, very cold that winter, and the night of the 25th was no exception. By the time the army reached McConkie's Ferry at twilight, large chunks of ice were quickly moving on the river. Washington had sent several other generals and their men to other areas around Trenton with a plan for them all to attack at the same time. But about 6 p.m., word arrived that the other generals would not be taking part in the attack. They had made their own decisions. One believed he should be in charge. Another could not get across the river in time. A couple of others believed the weather to be too bad for any type of an attack. Still, Washington and his army remained determined. About the same time, a small band of 20 to 30 American soldiers attacked a Hessian outpost and wounded about 5 or 6 men. The Hessians sounded the alarm and sent a company after the rebels. Shortly, though, after finding nothing, they returned to Trenton with the belief that it was just another small band of locals trying to annoy them. Life was soon back to normal and a lot of celebrating. As the night went on, it became one of the worst in the winter. It was so cold. The frost was heavy. The current on the river was fast. The ice flows seemed to increase each minute. The wind blew hard. And at 11 p.m., it began to snow. As Washington's army reached the Delaware River, word was sent to the soldiers from Marblehead. They were from outside of Boston, Massachusetts, and were fishermen by trade. They were the ones who saved the army during the Long Island retreat. They would now once again play an important role. Their experience helped them to ferry the men across the river. It was slow going because of all the ice in the river. But by 3 a.m. on the morning of the 26th, all the men, horses, and cannons were safely on the other side. It did, however, take another hour before everyone could be organized. They then began the 9-mile march through the snow and ice to Trenton. The strong northeast storm of wind, sleet, and hail met them with each step. A small detachment of soldiers caught up with Washington shortly by following the bloody footprints left in the snow by the soldiers. Many of the soldiers were making the march with holes in their shoes, or some with no shoes at all, just feet wrapped up in rags. When the army reached Birmingham, they divided into two groups. One group under General Sullivan stayed near the river, but shortly realized their guns had become wet and would not fire. Washington, whose group had gone down Pennington Road, sent order for Sullivan's men to use bayonets and to go into town of Trenton. The soldiers only had to hear the words, and their bayonets were fixed as they were eager to go. Back in Trenton, the Hessians had been sleeping undisturbed. All the patrols had reported that all was quiet. As Washington neared Trenton, it is reported that he asked a man who was chopping wood, "Which way is the Hessian picket?" The man, who was afraid, told Washington, "I do not know." One of Washington's officers rode up and told the man, "You may tell, for this is General George Washington." The man then cried, "God bless and prosper you. The picket is in that house, and the sentry stands near that tree." Thus Washington's men attacked the picket on Pennington Road, while Sullivan's men attacked the picket near the river. As Sullivan's men attacked it, the Hessians ran out of their barracks, but were so startled by the attack that they turned and ran into the forest. At one point in the battle, Washington was riding in front of his army as they were forming and setting up 6 cannons. He was thus a good mark for someone to shoot. Although his horse was shot out from underneath him, Washington remained unhurt. The Hessians soon began to withdraw, leaving their cannons. They might all have gotten away, except they refused to leave their plunder. They returned to fight, but were quickly surrounded and then quickly surrendered. The total action in the battle took only 35 minutes. No American lives were lost, none. At least 946 Hessians were taken prisoners. 17 Hessians were killed. Over 162 Hessians escaped to the British lines. Washington's prize was 1,200 small arms, ammunition, and 6 cannons, 2 of which were large-sized cannons. The Pennsylvania Lutherans wrote, "Till that hour, the light of the United States flickered like a dying flame, but the Lord of hosts heard the cries of the distressed and sent an angel for their deliverance. Trenton was captured, the battle won, but the plan was not finished. Washington marched his men back across the Delaware River that night. After only a very, very short rest and little food, the troops were now worn out by cold, the rain, the snow. Boy, they needed sleep and the care of almost 1,000 prisoners. They again marched out in the sleet across the river. Once across, they would wait for reinforcements, supplies, and for the British General Cornwallis to come after them. Cornwallis, Washington knew, would be really angered by the Battle of Trenton and would now come after the American army. Washington had outwitted Cornwallis before, and, well, he would do it again. As Washington's troops regrouped, they realized that the enlistment of almost half the army was up in a few days more. Washington asked the men to stay on and continue the battle. The troops believed in what they were fighting for, and in one mighty cheer said yes, they would stay. Each day that passed brought more volunteers. More soldiers also meant more money was needed to pay them. Washington and his officers began to borrow money by pledging their own personal fortunes. Now, the Quakers did not believe in fighting. Yet on January 1st, a man by the name of Robert Morris went from door to door in Philadelphia, which had a large Quaker community, to raise money with which to pay the soldiers. By the next day, Morris was able to send Washington $50,000. By January 2nd, over 5,000 men had joined Washington. That same day, Cornwallis, with 5,000 British and Hessian troops, begin to march towards the Continental Army. The British Army was harassed all the way by the local militia. About a mile from the Trenton, 600 Americans under General Greene, with 2 cannons, stopped the British and Hessians for a while. Greene and his men quickly rejoined Washington. The British troops came up against the full American army, but where Cornwallis was tired from the march and his troops were superior, so he decided to stop for the night. Cornwallis ordered camp made and turned in for a restful sleep, believing victory would be his by the morning. There was no rest, however, for Washington that night. All seemed to be falling in place for his plan. He knew well that the back roads of the area by this time, it was soon discovered that the road to Princeton was left unguarded. Washington ordered a small company of men to keep large campfires going, dig trenches, and make a whole lot of noise. The rest of his army quietly began to march to Princeton. And by God's providence, the wind changed and became very cold. The roads, which a few hours had been muddy, became frozen, which allowed for easy movement of the cannons. The British, meanwhile, believed all was well and suspected nothing. About sunrise, Washington's army arrived outside Princeton. Most of the British troops had been sent to join Cornwallis. The Americans quickly began to prepare for battle and set up the cannons. But due to fatigue from their march, they were discouraged. Washington rode out in front of the army to within 30 yards of the British lines while they were forming. Each side fired a volley. There was a big panic. I'm sure in the hearts of the Americans, their beloved leader was in the path of the fire. The smoke cleared. Washington, by God's grace, was untouched. The whole battle was over in less than 20 minutes. 200 British were killed. 230 were taken prisoner. Only a small number of Americans were killed. Back outside Trenton, Cornwallis woke to the surprise of finding no Washington and no Continental Army. The cannons firing in the direction of Princeton told him that he had been tricked. Perhaps that is why the British called Washington the Old Fox. Cornwallis quickly set out with his army towards Princeton, but reached it just as the last of Washington's troops were leaving. Washington and his men fell back to Morristown, Pennsylvania, knowing that since it was a rebel stronghold, the British would not dare to follow. The battles around Trenton and Princeton were the first American victories in the Revolution. A clear message was sent. Britain and the rest of Europe that Americans intended to win. Within a month of the battles, a proclamation was issued by Washington that anyone sympathetic with the British should move behind the British lines. The British lines at this point in the war included only the areas around Fort Niagara, New York Harbor, and Rhode Island. The rest of the country lay in the hands of the Continental Army. One British historian was to later write of how the American army complained, and not of the cold, not of the lack of sleep, not of the lack of food, no. Not even the lack of money or clothes. They complained only that Washington did not take better care of himself during the battle and was always in the middle of the action. The British had no idea of the love and respect this man received from the new nation. Washington's army was devoted to him. And we end with this. It is my prayer as we end this book and the study of the seven principles that you will remember what can happen if a unique individual created by God for the purpose uses Christian self-government in his own life, remembers his heritage and what God has done, not only in his life, but in the life of this country of ours. Listen to his conscience. Remembers that our government is based on biblical principles. Not only remember, but teaches others and prays, and takes action to join with others to ensure that the right things happen in this country. I'm going to stop right there. And we're just going to go around. Joe, we only have a few minutes left. How much time do I have left? Okay. And so did you have a very quick, short one you wanted to do?
Yes. Yes, I did. It was a story Ronald Reagan told. He told this about the World War II. I'll kind of cut it short. There was a story night during the Battle of the Bulge on Christmas Eve. A mother and a young son living alone in a cottage in the middle of the woods. And all around them there was war, and they could hear the sounds of explosions and battle. It was Christmas Eve when three young American soldiers arrived at the mother and her son's door. And it was the son that told this story. They were standing there in the snow, lost behind enemy lines. They were frostbitten. One was badly wounded. Even though sheltering the enemy was punishable by death, the young mother took them in and made them a supper with some of her last food. While they were sitting down, there was another knock at the door. And this time, there were four German soldiers standing there. The woman was afraid, but said in a firm voice, "There'll be no shooting here." She made all the soldiers lay down their weapons, and they all came in and sat and joined in the makeshift meal. Hines and Willie, turned out, were only 16. Their corporal, the oldest, at 23. They were all pretty suspicious of one another. But the suspicions dissolved in the warmth and comfort of the cottage. One of the Germans was a former medical student, tended to the very wounded American. Now, listen to the eyes of the rest of the story through the eyes of one who was there, a grown man, that had been her son. He said, "The mother said grace. I noticed there were tears in her eyes when she said the old familiar word, 'Come, Herr Jesus, be our guest.' And as I looked around the table, I saw tears, too, in the eyes of the battle-weary soldiers. Boys again, some from America, some from Germany, all far from home. That night, as the storm of war tossed the world, they had their own private armistice. And the next morning, the German corporal showed the Americans how to get back to their own lines. They all shook hands and went their separate ways. That happened to be Christmas Day 40 years ago." Well, this was done in 1944-45. These boys had reconciled briefly in the middle of war. Surely we could think about peace this Christmas, peace on earth, goodwill to men. It was the governments that made war, the citizens that fought the wars for their government. But that night it was the citizens that made peace. Peace on Christmas Eve because of Jesus Christ.
Amen. Well, we're out of time for tonight, so one by one, we're all going to say, may this be your most blessed Christmas ever.
May this be your most blessed Christmas ever.
May this be your most best Christmas ever.
Go ahead, Joe.
May this be the very most blessed Christmas you've ever had. And maybe you can start some new traditions tonight to make Christmas even more special for your children, for your grandchildren, for all the tomorrows yet ahead.
All right, and as we always say at this time, I want to thank all of you out there again. God bless. Merry Christmas.
God bless. Merry Christmas.
And always, always, keep fighting the fight.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of the Christian Resistance. What's Right, What's Left, hosted by Pastor Ernie Sanders. To learn more about our ministry, please visit us online at www.wrwl.org. Please tune in next time for another edition of What's Right, What's Left.
The preceding program is sponsored by What's Right, What's Left Ministries and is responsible for its content.
Hey, girl. Yes, you. You are seen. You are loved. And you were made for more. Hey, created especially for teen girls, chart-topping Christian artist Ann Wilson invites you to her 40-day devotional, Hey Girl, through honest stories, scripture, and journal prompts. Ann talks about real struggles, comparison, insecurity, doubt, and faith, reminding you that God is always near and fighting for you. Hey Girl, from K-Love Books. Get your copy today at klove.com/books.